Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet.
Hello, my name is Alexander Kovesh and welcome to our podcast. I am your traditional host and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. When we started this podcast series, we imagined it to become a collaborative project across the European Society for Ecological Economics community, where people can volunteer to be hosts and guests and can suggest topics or experts they would like to listen to. And finally, I'm happy to say, in the second series, this is really happening. I'm truly happy to introduce the audience to the new co-host we have, Sofusu Emgassen, who will have great conversations with our guests to come. He decided to have his first episode talking to me. That is a real honor. So welcome, Sofus. But before we swap roles, tell us first a little about yourself and why you decided to co-host Economics for Rebels with me.
Thanks so much for welcoming me onto the show, Sandra. It's an absolute joy to be here doing my favorite thing, right? Which is basically talking to inspiring ecological economists about cool, new, innovative ideas in ecological economics. I've been an ecological economist for most of the last 10 years, based in the UK. And I just want to play a part in getting the message out there about ecological economics. You know, in my view, the economics for the 21st century, whose time has come. So thanks so much for being here, Sandra. So the first stage in having ideas accepted in culture and people's lives is getting these ideas to them in the first place. And there are a few people who have done more getting the messages of ecological economics out there in numerous languages and countries than our guest and my co-host today, Professor Alexandra Kovesh. So Sandra is the founder and the host of the Economics for Rebels podcast, as well as a sustainability and ecological economics podcast in Hungarian called Green Equality, which is one of the country's most popular science podcasts, which is a huge achievement for any ecological economist. Sandra is an associate professor at the Corvinus University of Budapest, who, alongside all the communication work, is also an academic ecological economist, using methodological tools such as backcasting for envisaging sustainability transitions. So welcome to your own show, Sandra.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So for several years, you've been chatting interesting ideas with people throughout ecological economics, and I've been listening that whole time. And you've been speaking with guests from a multitude of research fields. And every time I go to an ecological economics conference, I come across a bunch of really interesting new ideas that make me think differently about the world and that I learn a lot from. So, from your experience, what are the few of the most interesting, innovative new ideas that you've come across from speaking with a huge community of sustainability practitioners, you know, those ideas that really made you think or changed your perspective?
Well, I couldn't really just name a few. It's ecological economics overall that's really interesting to me, and it has fascinated me for about 13 years. And I come from a different background. I didn't just go from university into this line of thought. In the first decade of my career, I worked with development policy, especially social development, and especially with European Union-funded projects. And when I worked with development policy, after a decade of working there, I had the feeling that whatever we were doing was like completely wrong. I mean, even the most common understandings of what development is just wrong. And no matter how much money we're throwing at the problem, we're not going to get any better. So I started having these questions in my own head. And when I first came across ecological economics, I was really intrigued to actually see the same questions that I had in my mind when working with development policy. And then I totally immersed myself in the ideas. And of course, in this job that I had, you know, everything what ecological economics was saying was like news to me. because I was used to the neoliberal understanding of development that and ecological economics was saying growth is unattainable, GDP is useless, development is still colonial, the roots of the social problems are the same as the roots of the ecological problems. And, you know, I was just not used to that. And wow, there was one field that actually, you know, tried to find answers to the same questions that I was trying to wrap my head around. And I was 35 at the time, but all my doubts were reflected by this research field. And I felt it really thrilling to put these puzzles together. And I think that ecological economics is quite coherent in its narratives. And this might be debated by a lot of ecological economists because they say that, you know, we have huge arguments, we have a myriad of ideas and very different views within the community. We have radicals and we have those who are like closer to environmental economists and we have very different answers to the same problems. But nonetheless, I think we do have a coherent narrative. And I was really amazed to see that when I first started reading the most basic works of ecological economics. And what I love the most about ecological economics is the systems thinking, the capability to transcend the linear atomistic thinking we are so used to since the Enlightenment. Ecological economists tend to understand the dynamic relationships, the complexity, and they actually have answers as how to deal with it, how to deal with this complexity, and how to deal with systems that are interlinked and hugely complicated. And once you change one thing, a lot of other things also change. And you just have to accept that. You just have to accept the clumsy solutions that you're proposing to these challenges. And actually, this is why having these very different approaches and these very different answers to the or possible solutions to these problems, this makes sense in a systems view. This makes sense in a network. Because whether you're trying to find local solutions or global solutions, radical solutions or reformist solutions or bottom-up or top-down, I believe they all lead to the emergence of something new. And deep at heart, I'm probably a lost philosopher. So I absolutely love the conversations in ecological economics that deal with how we actually think of the world around us. And even how we treat science, like ecological economics being a follower, or most ecological economists are being followers of post-normal science, where this kind of complexity is accepted and we don't want to repress our value-laden scientific understandings. We actually acknowledge that science is value-laden and that we need to move beyond this idea of enlightenment that everything is objective, especially in social sciences. You can actually exclude subjectivity from science. And I also like engaging with people who are more on the activist side of things. And I like engaging with them because I think that is actually what I myself probably lack the most. And there are plenty of people like that in ecological economics. So this is what I like about ecological economics, and it's very difficult to name just a few. I think it's the whole narrative that I have bought into some time ago, and that I try to represent when I talk to people, whether they are my students or other experts or politicians for that matter.
Yeah, that was a way more beautiful answer than I was expecting. I love that. I also remember the moment when I was working in as a traditional job in the city, and then my eyes were kind of opened to the way that ecological economics views the world. And it was actually reading Tim Jackson's Prosperity Without Growth at work that made me quit my job, do my master's in ecological economics, and change the course of my career. So I really empathize with everything that you've just said there about dynamic complexity. And I found it such an eye-opening and interesting way of viewing the world. So over the last few years, like, you've discussed ecological economics with hundreds of people, you know, in Hungarian and in English, and you've been communicating these ideas to the public. You've been one of the biggest advocates for getting these ideas out there. So a quick question on that. Ultimately, if we want to live in a sustainable economy, we need to start winning the battle of ideas and public discourse. So what's stuck with you about which themes of ecological economics have resonated the best when you've been speaking with people in the public?
Well, I have the feeling that people are absolutely dying to have new narratives and new positive narratives, because dystopias about the future are really easily accessible. If you think of art and if you think of movies and if you think of just pop conversations, when people think of the future, they tend to think of dystopias. And especially when the state of the environment comes into the picture. And somehow the narratives that capitalism is offering us at the moment, the narratives are, they no longer present us with something that we'd like to strive for. So I have the feeling that this is the key, that people do need different narratives. We live in a world where the old narratives no longer work, but there are no new ones. And I think ecological economics offers these kind of new narratives. And I also find that people can really relate to the psychological perspectives of ecological economics. This might be surprising because we don't tend to talk about that a lot, but I think people are actually fed up with the positive psychology of neoliberalism that says that everything depends on you and you yourself can be rich, famous, and above all happy if you want to. And people feel that that's not true. And they feel that they work more and more and they have less and less chances, and just getting richer doesn't make us happy. And so whenever we talk about changing the way we think about our lives and we think about the fair use of resources, and we don't just say this is going to be tough on you because you'll have to do that no matter what, you have to give up. What we're actually thinking is that there's a lot of space to like rediscover what well-being means to you. And well-being is by, you know, no means equivalent to economic prosperity. And I have the feeling that people can really relate to that. They also feel they want to slow down. They also feel that we actually had a really interesting research in the largest marketing communications firm in Hungary. And the people who worked in there, it wasn't going to be a sustainability project. We were just going to use the research method of backcasting in this business setting and see how that worked. But when people were giving the space to actually think about their future, they expressed their real concern that if they keep working in that industry, they will not be able to face their children in 20 years' time. And when their children will ask, so where were you in 2020 when everyone could see that the world was collapsing? And they said, we can't possibly just say we worked in the marketing industry. And yes, in their everyday lives, they do what they do and they work in the thumping heart of capitalism. But when you actually ask them, is this what you want? And you give them the space to think, they're like, no, I don't think I can actually face my children if I continue doing that. But, you know, we hardly ever give people the space to think about that. So this is why I think narratives are really important. If they can buy into these narratives, then their own psychological well-being can improve. And of course, you were asking what else received the most public attention. And of course, some of the very specific policy suggestions, you know, can also raise a lot of awareness. And things like work time reduction or unconditional basic allowance, these kind of things also make good topics for debates, because once you start debating them in the neoclassical frame of mind, they don't make much sense. But as soon as you actually tell people how these can be used as tools and tools that make a transition that they actually want to make, they all start making sense. So these are really useful points and debates in public, because I have had the experience that people can actually change their minds. I mean, I have people come up to me and said, I have never, ever thought of unconditional basic allowance as a tool for ecological transition. So these are worth talking about.
Brilliant. What are those narratives that you think we can use to win the battle of public ideas and public discourse? You know, which specific narratives do you think we can rely on?
Well, that actually being good for the environment and moving towards more social justice is not a utopian thing. It's good for you as a person, it's good for you as a community, and it's good for the world. So it's not about giving up or not. Yes, you might have to give up on things. You have to give up on you know, flying to the Seychelles twice a year. But giving up that, what you can actually gain from living in a more just world and losing that kind of pressing existential threat that we now live in, or having the feeling that you're actually doing something about it, can really balance out what you think you're kind of giving up in the current narrative. So I really think that, you know, living well within ecological boundaries is a narrative that people can buy into if you can convince them actually that we're not just homo economicus, you know, being hugely selfish and stupid and we're all doomed to go down. So if you actually manage to convince them that we're a lot more than that, and all we have done is we have picked one human trait and built a whole institutional setup around it, and then now we're really surprised that actually people who are selfish and utility maximizing individuals, they are the most successful. But of course, yes, we've built a whole system around that, but that doesn't mean that we can't build a new system around a more appealing human trait. And it's actually our capability to cooperate that drove us into this, you know, situation. So yes, these are narratives that we need to focus on. But the challenge is that we are trying to communicate a really complex issue, a really, really complex issue. And of course, we need to use simplicity. We need to use simple messages, because this is how people start listening. And this, I think, we find really, really difficult, because we know that things aren't that simple. You can't just do this and not do like a million other things at the same time. Because if you just stop growing, then that's not degrowth. That's actually an economic collapse, and nobody wants that. But people listen to simple ideas and buy into simple ideas. So this is a real challenge for ecological economics to start communicating complex issues with simplicity. I always think we just need a few spin doctors who can actually translate our complex messages, our systemic views into ideas that are then being debated in the public. And of course, there's another challenge when communicating ecological economics is that we somehow need to balance the message that we're all doomed and that there is a potential threat that we all die. And we need to balance that message that actually responding to these threats can actually build a better world. And the problem is that we tend to lose most people with the first, you know, part of the message. We just submitted a paper to Ecological Economics saying that actually our lack of death awareness in our Western societies is actually hindering us from tackling, from facing the transitions that we need for moving from a consumerist society into something that's more convivial, but also at the same time sustainable, simply because when we superficially address existential threats, we suddenly, this is what existential psychologists have long worked on, that when we superficially face these existential threats and we hear about them, we start focusing on our status, on our current culture, and reinforce these ideas. While if we had a more in-depth understanding of death and what it means to us, then transcendence management would probably mean that we start focusing on more on our on the quality of our relationships and the meaning of our lives. So this is a kind of challenge for ecological economics in its communications, that, you know, you can't basically say we need to build a different world, because unless we do it, we are in deep trouble, but also fight people saying, oh, well, I don't want to think of deep trouble, or when I think of it, I actually want to stick to the culture that, that we have now. So that these are the challenges of communicating ecological economics in my understanding.
That's brilliant. I'm looking forward to seeing that paper come out as well. Yeah, I mean, I mean, from my experience, if I think about the kind of conversations I have, I always get attacked for kind of a lack of political realism. But I always try and reframe that discussion. I mean, as, you know, continuing with business as usual is a complete lack of ecological realism. I mean, it transgresses environmental limits that have not been transgressed in human history, and just seriously risks destabilizing society. I mean, how unrealistic is that, continuing forward with that pathway? As we've talked about, I mean, you've been speaking to people all over the world, and just a question to your specific context, and what kind of reception have you and these ideas had in Hungary? Because I think, you know, the majority of our listeners probably won't be from Hungary, and it would just be interesting to hear what kind of the local flavor of ecological economics is in Hungary, and what issues get the most attention there.
Well, it's really, really controversial, as you can imagine, because the current situation in Hungary in politics is that people buy into this, I probably can only say crap of illiberal democracy as their answer to their disillusionment with neoliberalism. And this fact can also be supportive to ecological economics, but can also obviously hinder the understanding of ecological economics. So basically, it's an opportunity, because ecological economics is saying the same thing. Neoliberalism has driven us to a place where we don't want to be. We need to move on. So this is a narrative that attacks the same idea, but at the same time provides alternatives, because of course the liberal democracy that we now have here is not an alternative to neoliberalism. It's actually neoliberal in itself, but in terms of PR or communications, it attacks neoliberalism. So in a sense it's an opportunity. But on the other hand, you know, we are riding against the waves of a narrative that has a very simple message, and ours is still too complicated to fight that. On the other hand, we have pretty good traditions, like, for example, on food sharing, on food self-provisioning, on cycling. But, you know, currently or in the last 30 years, they have been seen as symbols of poverty. And these kind of things that are now in many Western societies are being thought of as something advanced, something special, something that you're doing for yourself and for the world. Here in Hungary, we do it. We do it less and less because of our so-called development, but we do it, but we still find it's a symbol of poverty. This needs to be changed. We need to start being proud of what we're doing and not see it as being something backward. And of course, when in ecological economics, you're saying that these are actually good things, you know, people have the feeling, well, you know, do they actually want to make us lag behind even more or, you know, become poor? And there's also one interesting thing. I used to live in the UK and I spent a few years in Austria as well. The strange thing is, you know, I mean, in the UK, they've had this kind of economic system for a long, long time. But in Hungary, we've only had it for like 30 years. So the idea is really strange how people in Hungary cannot understand that it's perfectly possible to live in a different economic setting, even if they actually only 30 years ago they lived in one, or well, in a different one. So that can also, you know, be a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, well, it's pretty easy for us to imagine that there could be a different economic system. But on the other hand, for example, you know, when we talk about ecological economics and we kind of attack capitalist ideas, of course, this kind of resonates with the ideas that we used to hear under communism. But of course, it wasn't communism, it was state capitalism. But when they hear these kind of criticisms, they think, well, we don't want to go back there. We don't want communism. So the challenge, for example, in Hungary, and I guess that's the case in most Central and Eastern European countries, is that we have to make people understand that what we are offering is not the state capitalism that they had or that they lived through. And that is also quite difficult and a challenge.
Yeah, that's back to the marketing message. Which messages and narratives is ecological economics going to use to win these battles of public ideas? I think that it's all connected there. So in some of your own work that I've read, you've had some really interesting thoughts about why it is that political leaders struggle to take decisions aligned with the goals of ecological economics. So like redirecting the economy, so its ecological impacts fall within the scale of what the Earth can sustain. And would you be interested in sharing some of your insights from that work here?
Yes. Politicians are pretty systematic in their thinking. They're not daft. It is only their motivations that are really narrow. Basically, all they want to do is to stay in power or grab power. So unless we manage to make our perspectives attractive to the electorates that can keep them in power or, you know, make them move them into power, unless we speak to these electorates and they make these political responses necessary to have a response to the problems that we have, unless we make them attractive to electorates so that they demand the politicians to have these responses, we will not have what we want. So I have the feeling that, you know, it's very difficult to think that one day politicians will actually wake up and say, well, you know, we need to build a different world. They will start building a different world in our pretty bad, current, hugely faulty representative democratic systems. That's another issue that we need to discuss, especially in ecological economics, that we need to change the rules of the game and we need to move towards deliberative, participative democracies. But until we do that, or until we manage to do that, I think we just have to make the electorate aware that they should just demand politicians to have a say on these type of issues. So basically what we need is more visibility in these ideas, because once the electorate understands these, they will make it important for politicians to respond to these challenges. And I think more and more people are buying into these narratives and they do want to hear these kind of responses. And I think especially the younger generations are probably more prone to demand these kind of responses.
Yeah, so we can't look to our political leaders to be the instigators of change. They actually follow the views and the demands of the electorate. That's the overall takeaway.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, yeah. It's sad because it's a major challenge. I mean, I think every ecological economist lives with the hope and the vision that we will receive some political support and guidance in this. But I really agree with that. It fundamentally falls to us to try and make these messages as electorally palatable as possible, I think. So to close it out, I'd like to focus a little bit on some more methodological stuff, because one of the aims of this podcast is also to introduce ecological economists to the kind of range of methodological approaches and guides to how we can use those in ecological economics to tackle these relevant questions. And I've been interested in a lot of your work on the way you use backcasting. So do you mind giving us a quick introduction to backcasting, as well as the kind of problems in ecological economics that you think it can be used to solve?
Yes, backcasting is a scenario building futures method. And what we use is particularly participatory backcasting, where we have panels discussing their visions. And of course, backcasting is a wordplay that's kind of the opposite of forecasting, because what we do in forecasting is we try to see the current trends and tendencies and try to build scenarios from these trends. While what backcasting is saying that sometimes when we build these scenarios based on current trends, we're not going to get to where we want to be. So we could just, and also people are actors in these trends. So what they think is possible or not possible, you know, they are active in building these societies, in building these ideas. So what we need is to change the direction of these thoughts and say, okay, so what is the future that we actually do want? And this is obviously a normative future. And then work our way back from that future saying, okay, so if this is what we want in, let's say, 2050, then where should we be in 2040? What should we do in 2030? And what can we do now in order to have a bigger chance of moving towards that kind of desired future? Of course, we can't guarantee we're getting there. I mean, the systems are too complex for that. But if we do these kind of things, we have better chances than if we don't do these kind of things. So when people ask me, so what is degrowth like? What is the future? You know, what is the world that ecological economics is about? And I'm like, you know, what does it look concretely? And I'm like, who knows? I haven't lived in one. Nobody has. So basically what we need is we need to enable people to see what it might be like if we are ready to make these kind of steps. And these are, of course, very policy-oriented research, because at the end, we come up with, not we as researchers, but the participants come up with recommendations for policymakers. And we have had research on topics like sustainable employment, sustainable business, sustainable consumption, the future role of marketing communications, sustainable support, cosmolocal production, the future of artificial intelligence. And it's quite exciting to see how it doesn't matter whether we work with lay panels or we work with expert panels. When we actually ask them what they would want the future to be, they come up with very similar values. And these values are pretty similar to those represented in ecological economics. I find this a fairly good method to build up these concrete narratives of how a just and sustainable world could actually look like, and then identify the exact steps that might lead us there.
I love that. So you work with a panel of lay people or experts, and everybody's sort of vision for their ideal future shares major similarities with the vision of ecological economics. I find that really nice that there's an idea there, that it's a kind of latent desire for that kind of economic organization.
Yes, true. And it's quite nice to experience that. And as I told you, it doesn't just happen when you actually say to people, well, just imagine sustainable business. It also happens when you just say, just imagine the future of artificial intelligence. So I think it wouldn't be that difficult to actually make people work towards the same goals, but they really need to get out of the current frames of mind. And I think to provide space for that, to provide a dialogue for that, would really be important so that we can all tap into what we really want the future to be.
So if you free our minds, there's a secret ecological economist in all of us. So thanks so much to Sandra for being a guest on her own show today. And to close out the episode, Sandra, I'm asking you the question. You ask all your guests, what is your rebellion?
I knew that at some point someone will ask me that question. And I will have to admit that I am no rebel at all. When we think of rebels, we think of radical thinkers and radical doers. And I don't consider myself either of them, to be honest. But I do consider myself a believer in the system's view of life, as Vityov Capra calls it. So I believe that in complex systems, the emergence of new traits and new systems, they come from highly dynamic and chaotic relationships and events. And we are all part of this. And such transitions and transformations, they cannot be managed, they cannot be planned, and least of all, they cannot be controlled. You can, however, exert impulses on the current systems, and these impulses can induce emergence. So my understanding is that if we want to hope that new systems will emerge, we need to provide these impulses, but we don't know where and how these will take place. So we need radicals and reformists and top-down and bottom-up approaches, and everyone has a role to play in this. And what I want to contribute to is to make people understand that in such complex systems, they can make autonomous decisions, but not independent decisions. And that their decisions do matter in what emerges in the systems as a whole. So if they have proper understandings of the new narratives, if we all have proper understandings of possible potential new narratives, then we might actually individually work towards the same thing. We might not be able to control, but you know, I think the impulses can lead to such dynamic conditions where those new traits and new systems can emerge. And I just see myself as a tiny little node in that network and you know, one of the people who might insert these impulses into the system.
Yeah, personally, I think hosting two ecological economic podcasts in two different languages is pretty rebellious and cool. So, Sandra, thanks so much for spending time with us today. Thanks to all our listeners for spending time with us. And please stay tuned for our next episode.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.